So in early January, we started to see an escalation of violence in Ecuador. And then the most important and powerful gang leader in Ecuador, known as Fito, escaped from prison.
Samantha Schmidt covers Latin America for The Post. Fito's full name is José Adolfo Macias Villamar. The fact that he'd escaped from prison by basically walking out the front door was jarring.
Ecuador was always this sort of peaceful haven in South America, surrounded by neighbors like Colombia and Peru that suffered from, you know, decades of guerrilla violence. It was seen as this sort of ecotourism hub, but in recent years, all of that has changed. We've had a wave of gang violence, a presidential candidate who had strongly spoken out against corruption and drug trafficking. He was killed while leaving a campaign rally. This country that had previously been an outlier in the region was suddenly one of the most dangerous countries in Latin America.
And now, Ecuador's new president, Daniel Noboa, faced a critical point. He had campaigned as a center-right hardliner against crime, pledging to build more prisons. He had to act.
He declares a state of emergency.
Acabo de firmar el decreto de estado de excepción para que las Fuerzas Armadas tengan todo el respaldo político y legal en su accionar.
Noboa addresses the nation, looking into the camera, wearing a slick black bomber jacket. He's 36, the son of a banana tycoon, and he's only been in office for about a month at this point. And then he says,
Nosotros no vamos a negociar con terroristas, ni descansaremos hasta devolverle la paz a todos los ecuatorianos.
We will not negotiate with terrorists, nor will we rest until we return peace to all Ecuadorians. But Sam says no one was prepared for what came next.
In the days that followed, things only got worse.
Sam and our colleague Arturo Torres have spent months reconstructing what happened after Noboa declared the state of emergency. It was January 9th, the day Ecuador nearly collapsed. They began by meeting with President Noboa himself.
I started telling him that we wanted to know what happened on January 9th and how he made the decisions that he made that day. And instead of just telling us about it, he started offering to talk us through and walk us through everything that happened that day and where it happened. We were just outside of his office, and he walked us to the gym. And at first, I didn't know exactly why, but he told us that that was where he was when he made the most difficult decision of his life.
From the newsroom of The Washington Post, this is Post Reports. I'm Martine Powers. It's Wednesday, April 17th. Today, through exclusive interviews and footage, my colleague Samantha Schmidt helps us make sense of what exactly happened that defining day in Ecuador, a day that came to a dramatic head for all of the country and the world to witness.
The storming of a TV station by armed assailants was shocking.
We unpack how exactly Ecuador got to this point, and why all of this is being viewed as a warning sign for the rest of Latin America. Sam, let's start by unpacking that day, January 9th. So Noboa tells you that it all begins at the gym?
It started out at about 5 in the morning, and he was working out as he often does at that hour.
¿Qué ejercicio estaba haciendo ese día?
No, ese día estaba en el treadmill cuando...
Running on the treadmill. And he saw the news that another important gang leader had escaped prison. The same gang leader who had threatened to kill the attorney general of Ecuador. Apparently, he escaped by carving a hole through a brick wall in the prison. In that moment, when he saw that yet another gang leader had escaped, he told me later that it felt like he was living in Gotham.
No lo tomen esto literal, mm-hmm. pero estábamos como en Gotham.
Mm-hmm. He said we needed to take control. They needed to do something disruptive, something that Ecuador had never seen before.
Uno que no se había hecho antes.
He said he immediately got off the treadmill and called the interior minister.
La llamé a la ministra de gobierno.
And told her, let's do it. Let's move forward with the plan, which was something that has never happened before in Ecuador, but it would be to declare a state of an armed internal conflict against the gangs and to officially declare the gangs as terrorist groups. To give the military complete power to tackle the gangs as if they were enemy combatants. And so they're no longer following the normal laws of day-to-day life in Ecuador. They are now following international humanitarian laws of war.
Wow. And what was it like for him to make this decision that morning? I mean, what was he like weighing as he was trying to figure out what to do here?
One of his big campaign promises from the beginning was to take control of the prisons and to take control of the country. And remember, Ecuador had historically been this really peaceful country. And suddenly, they recorded last year 44 homicides for every 100,000 residents, a 75% increase from a year before. And these prisons are command centers for these gangs. And so imagine the embarrassment of, in your first months in office, seeing these top gang leaders escape easily from prison, prisons that they controlled. Immediately, what people told me was that this could set up a really risky situation where suddenly you're trying to distinguish between residents and gang members when the gangs themselves are a complicated mix of 22 different groups. They are often made up of children. So how do you decide who is the enemy and who isn't?
So Noboa is getting ready to move forward with this big, heavy decision after learning that yet another gang member has escaped. That's how the day, January 9th, starts. But as you said, this was just the beginning of what happened that day. What happens next?
By pure coincidence, Arturo, my colleague, an Ecuadorian journalist, was in the Intelligence Command Center in Quito. He happened to be there that morning and was speaking with intelligence officials.
Suddenly, the intelligence command center was upside down, and nobody knows exactly what was going on.
They were suddenly bombarded with calls and reports from across the country about different attacks that were happening
in cities like Guayaquil, Esmeraldas, and Quito.
And there was all of a sudden this flurry, this rush to try to figure out what was going on. Police officers across the country started getting inundated with 911 calls, like this one about a car bomb. Everyone suddenly felt like there was a potential suspicious device on their street. You started getting all of these videos on Twitter and across social media.
Dentro del centro comercial estamos atrapados dentro de
of people panicking in malls, in universities, in metro stations, claiming that there was a bomb, and suddenly it was impossible to know what was true and what wasn't.
At least 4 Ecuadorian police officers have been kidnapped, and there have been explosions in several cities.
You saw reports of Molotov cocktails thrown at gas stations.
People everywhere was just desperate, trying to go back to their homes.
Bombs exploding at police stations, prison guards being held hostage in prisons. So it was sort of a avalanche of attacks that started building over the course of the day.
Just hearing this tape, and you can hear in people's voices how frightened and confused they were. Sam, I know that you did a lot of reporting to reconstruct that day. How did all of this come to a head?
So it was already a busy news day that day in TC Televisión in Guayaquil, which is the biggest city in Ecuador. And TC Televisión is known as one of Ecuador's most popular news shows. And Alina Manrique, who is the editor-in-chief of the newsroom, she was trying to make sense of all of these reports that were coming in.
Estaba en mi puesto. Estaba revisando los libretos para ese noticiero. Estaba normal todo.
She says, I was in my spot in the newsroom, preparing the scripts for the news program. Everything was normal. And then suddenly they get a text message in a WhatsApp group for the staff of the news channel saying,
nos quieren matar a todo en TC. Urgente, nos quieren matar en TC.
Whoa. They want to kill us. They're trying to kill us at TC.
Oh my gosh.
A colleague then races past her saying, let's go, let's go. They got in.
Vamos, 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 mija, que se nos metieron. Y corrió.
And then she hears gunshots and glass shattering and screams. And quickly, she runs to the bathroom to hide.
And what was her understanding of, like, what was happening outside?
Nobody knew in those first moments. But quickly, they saw and heard through their WhatsApp messages from colleagues that armed, masked men had come in with weapons. And they immediately started looking for especially news anchors and prominent people that they could bring with them as hostages into the TV studio. The cameras are rolling, and this is that footage from that moment. You can hear the sound of the normal suspenseful music that they always play during the news program. You see journalists on the ground with guns to their heads. People are crying, they're terrified.
Wait, so this was going out on live TV?
This was on, like, live television.
People around Ecuador are watching this play out.
Most people I interviewed at the highest levels of government saw it on live TV.
Oh.
And suddenly in police stations across the country, everyone just said, turn on your TV. TC Televisión is under attack. The people who are being held hostage right now, many of their family members and friends are watching. And soon you'll see them start to put dynamite into the pockets of some. But you also see that the armed men are quite young. And some of them are kids, are 15 or 17, and they are confused and they clearly don't have a plan.
Yeah, what are they doing here? Like, what are they trying to get someone to agree to, or why are they taking these hostages? What are they trying to achieve?
Right here, they say, put us on air so they know that you don't play with the mafia. You don't mess with the mafia. They continue to try to get microphones. From time to time, there were gunshots.
Looks like chaos as all of this is unfolding.
And as the police are closing in, they get more and more scared.
You started out by talking about Alina Manrique, who was the editor-in-chief at the station, that she was hiding in the newsroom bathroom. What was going on with her at this point?
She later told me that in that moment, she was just thinking so much about her kids.
Yo estaba pensando mucho, mucho en mis hijos.
And she was also texting my colleague, Arturo, because they happen to be friends, since they're both journalists in Ecuador. And he's watching this all happen, and he's obviously wondering how she's doing. You know, she was kneeling on the toilet, and she was shaking so much that the toilet felt like it was going to come loose. They eventually were forced to walk out and surrender when the armed men found them in the bathroom. And then the men took them into the studio as hostages and forced them onto the ground, pulled her hair, yanked her necklace. And she was one of those people that you can see.
She's kind of cowering in the corner, yeah.
She's in the far right corner. And soon they worried that police could show up and immediately start firing, and that suddenly they would be caught in the middle.
So let's pause there for a second. I'm hoping you can just explain, like, what does it mean to have this happening so publicly, to have captured the intention of the country with these, you know, this hostage takeover and all these other acts of violence? Like, what did that say about the gangs and their power in that moment?
It just seemed like Ecuador was on the verge of collapse. I mean, we've seen a presidential candidate assassinated. We've seen hundreds of inmates die in prison massacres. But then to see an armed gang go on live television in the middle of the day and send this message, it just brought terror to the whole country. And it made them, I think the feeling for most Ecuadorians that day was, what's going to happen next? What else can they take over? Is there going to be a car bomb on my street? Is my kid going to be a victim? You couldn't hide from it. It was on live television in front of you, and everyone was on their lunch break watching TV at that time anyway. It was just total panic.
And what are police doing at this point? And how are they trying to, like, take back control of the situation?
So in Guayaquil, the police chief, Victor Herrera, got the news about the TV station attack. And he immediately deployed everyone to the TV station. But then it was the question of, how do we go inside the studio? Normally in these situations, the, you know, police officials wait for a hostage negotiator to arrive to sort of handle the situation. But Victor Herrera just decided, I'm not going to wait. I'm going in. And like, he is the one that is at the front. And suddenly he is face to face with these armed men trying to convince them to put down their weapons.
So what you're showing me is the police chief's body cam footage.
We're watching body cam footage that we got exclusively from the Guayaquil police. And we're seeing Victor Herrera, the police chief. He immediately tries to get everyone to calm down. He starts shouting, come to the front. Nothing's going to happen to you. We're trying to protect everyone. Just hand over your weapons. Put your hands up.
You can see that this is the studio where they've got some of the journalists and the gang members are there.
You can see some of them with their hands around the necks of the journalists, of the hostages.
Like they're using them as human shields.
Literally using them as human shields, yeah. But over the course of this, you know, minute and a half long video, you start to see the armed men, like, hand over their weapons, come closer to the front, and pretty quickly surrender to the police. And Alina Manrique was there. She's there in the front, crouched on the ground. So Alina told me that at some point they finally managed to detain all of the armed men, and the police officer started trying to help up the journalists. And she truly, like, she could not move. She could not get up because she was in such shock. And he helped her up and told her, it's okay, you're alive, you're safe. And it all happened to come under control relatively quickly. Somehow, in the middle of all of this gunfire, nobody was seriously injured. Nobody was killed at the TV station. But at that point, nobody knew what else could be happening. Everyone was just wondering what's going to come next.
What was going on in other parts of the country?
So that same afternoon and evening, in prisons across the country, there were prison guards that were held hostage by inmates. And there just continued to be more reports of car bombs, of killings. There were at least 9 people killed on the streets of Guayaquil. And there were threats at major institutions across the country. The attorney general, for example, had to evacuate. her office and be whisked away to a safe location because they had a bomb threat. So it was really only the beginning of a wave of violence that week. But quickly, within an hour or so of the TV station attack, there was a dramatic shift in the country.
The spiraling violence is the biggest test yet to face the newly elected young president.
The situation is among the first big security tests for Noboa.
And that afternoon, President Noboa signed this new state of internal armed conflict. Immediately, the military started mobilizing because now they were in control.
So how does Noboa communicate this to the rest of the country?
The next morning, he went on a radio show. The radio host asks,
¿Qué va a pasar ya con el decreto que acaba de firmar? ¿Qué hay que comunicarle a los ecuatorianos?
What would you like to tell Ecuadorians about these extremely difficult times that the country's in, especially over the last 48 hours?
Sí, bueno, que vivimos un momento muy duro y que este gobierno...
Noboa says pues, es un gobierno firme. These are difficult times, but this government is firm. And the time is over of governments that are weak.
De gobiernos tibios.
Y me parece que al firmar este documento, este,
the host asks, este, in este signing this document, are we in a state of war?
En estado de guerra.
Sí.
Yes, Noboa says. As journalists that day, we were all trying to make sense of what was going on. I was in touch constantly with my colleague Arturo, and I didn't even realize until afterward, reflecting on that day, of how scary it was for him as well. And this is somebody who has seen just about everything.
I never lived such an experience in my career. I'm reporting organized crime and corruption almost 30 years in Ecuador. And what happened that day in my country is a breaking point.
After the break, how Ecuador got to this breaking point and what happened next. So, Sam, knowing what you know now after investigating what exactly happened on January 9th in Ecuador, what does that tell you about how organized crime really works and how it's evolved in the country?
So these gangs have been a part of Ecuador for generations, but they started off as sort of smaller drug trafficking groups, you know, locally selling cocaine to, you know, local neighborhood markets. But over time, they grew and they grew, taking control of the prisons and becoming these massive organizations. They've started using extortion and, you know, controlling large swaths of the country. But yet they're made up of these often poor, often very young men and boys, sometimes as young as 13. And they've managed to recruit from a pool of people that were largely unemployed after the pandemic, you know, in a country that was very hard hit by the COVID-19 pandemic. And all of that helped these gangs to become these massive powerhouses. And a crucial moment was when they started teaming up with international drug cartels from Mexico, from places as far as away as Albania, who are, have kind of flooded the country with cash and started infiltrating the highest levels of government in Ecuador.
Es una guerra.
President Noboa told us at one point that they're made up of
40,000.
Collectively, 40,000 people, which is the size of the Ecuadorian army. But at the highest level, you know, they're run by people who, you know, could be considered CEOs of transnational companies.
So given that, the fact that there are so many people involved in these gangs, that you have 24 different gangs who ended up working together on this day, like, what led to this coordinated attack on January 9th across the country?
This all really started in December when the Attorney General, Diana Salazar, who is a powerhouse of an attorney general and also the first Black woman in that role, she announced the results of a sweeping investigation that is the largest and arguably the most important investigation into what is called narcopolitics in Ecuador's history.
Hoy, en coordinación con el eje investigativo de la Policía Nacional,
and she revealed the way in which drug trafficking had infiltrated the highest levels of government in the country. She also warned that this was going to make criminal gangs extremely uncomfortable and that it was only a matter of time before they struck back. And pretty soon after, we saw how these gangs started to come together and organize this coordinated series of attacks.
So here is one thing that I want to understand. If Ecuador has historically been this very peaceful place, and if it's been buffered from this kind of gang violence in the past, what changed? Like, what made it suddenly so vulnerable now?
The story of Ecuador is really a story of the rising global demand and supply of cocaine, which is shocking because you would think after decades of the United States' war on drugs and against cocaine in South America that we would not still be talking about cocaine. And yet the amount of cocaine being produced in South America is at record levels, double a decade ago, way bigger than during the years of Pablo Escobar in Colombia. And as anti-narcotics control, especially in Colombia, has increased, drug traffickers started looking for new routes, and Ecuador was in the perfect place because it also has a coastline that's poorly protected. The U.S. hasn't had a military base there since 2009, and it is not only in a perfect location, but they had these networks already in the country of these drug gangs controlling prisons, moving cocaine through the country. And so international drug traffickers took notice and they swept in and they brought huge amounts of cocaine into the ports. And what's interesting is, unlike in the past, this is not just a story of cocaine going to the United States. The drugs are now going all over the world. Europe and even Latin America have become almost as important of markets. But you're also seeing it go towards Asia, to Australia, to these really profitable markets at levels that we haven't seen before.
So if demand for cocaine is what really fueled the gangs in Ecuador and brought this historically peaceful place to its knees in this very shocking way, what does that tell you about how susceptible other countries are to this kind of thing happening there?
Yeah, I've been thinking about Ecuador as sort of a canary in a coal mine for other countries that are in similar situations that were previously just transit countries that maybe had a few small-time local drug trafficking groups that could be heading towards this. And I think about, you know, my family's from Costa Rica, where they also just had sort of a local, drug trafficking network, but now it's becoming an increasingly important transit country. We're also seeing drug traffickers use the southern cone of South America, countries like Chile, Uruguay, Paraguay, even Argentina are getting caught up in these international routes that you'd never really seen before. And I don't know that these countries are ready, and especially countries like Ecuador that were weak, that had struggling economies, that had institutions that were vulnerable to corruption, and drug traffickers took advantage of that.
So that brings us back to January 9th and the immediate aftermath. That afternoon, after the attack on the TV station that was aired on TV live, Noboa declares this war on gangs, basically really giving the military a lot more power that day. What happened and what did it mean to call gang members terrorists?
This gave a level of power to the military that it hasn't really had before. And it involved them in the day-to-day life of Ecuadorians in a whole new way. So you started to see military checkpoints on the streets. You started to see the military take control of prisons. You didn't need the sort of justifications that you needed before. And so, you know, there are lots of concerns about where this could go. And, you know, we saw a particularly concerning example just a couple of weeks ago when Noboa was emboldened in a way that we haven't really seen a president act in recent times. He sent security forces to storm the Mexican embassy to arrest a former vice president who had been seeking refuge there, who had been convicted on corruption charges.
Video shared by Mexico's foreign minister shows the moment Roberto Canseco, a Mexican diplomat, tries to stop the caravan with the VP from driving away and is tackled by police outside the embassy.
And this broke international diplomatic conventions.
Ecuador's raid of Mexico's embassy has caused outrage.
Mexico has severed diplomatic ties with Ecuador.
And it was widely criticized, even including by the U.S. and by neighbors that were seen as allies to Ecuador, widely seen as going way overboard and taking this to an extreme.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear more beyond this one incident at the embassy. How have people in Ecuador been responding to this kind of crackdown?
Polls suggest that Noboa is wildly popular right now. You know, people see him as trying something that Ecuador hasn't tried before. And it follows a similar approach as to one we've seen in El Salvador with Bukele.
The country's president, Nayib Bukele, doubling down.
Who has become a global sensation.
The government announcing that at least 50,000 people have been arrested.
Who has arrested and detained a huge portion of the country and often, you know, detains a person purely based on a tattoo. And I think that other governments are looking at people like Noboa and Bukele in El Salvador, and they're trying to find ways to copy them. But it's really hard to tell whether that's actually going to work. And so there's also this question of what is happening while these gangs are sort of staying quiet. Are they reorganizing? Are they planning something?
Sam, taking a step back, you've covered gangs and drug trafficking in Latin America for years, and you're based in Colombia. I'm curious what your takeaway is from this moment in Ecuador.
I think this is a sign that organized crime is really the biggest issue right now for Latin America. And I know that sounds like it's not new, but really we must emphasize that the level of violence we're seeing now and the level of infiltration of these organized groups is unlike any that we've seen in recent years in the region, even in a region that has dealt with insurgencies and armed groups and drug traffickers for decades. You know, Noboa and many Ecuadorians see this as a sort of existential crisis. You know, this is not what they're used to in this country, and they remember what it was like before when they could drive to the coast and feel safe.
O sea, esto no es gang violence y están peleando por cuatro cuadras.
You know, the way Noboa put it, like, this is not just a fight against local gang violence, you know, controlling a few blocks. This is a fight for ports, for borders, for entire towns.
Pelea por puertos, pelea por fronteras, pelea por pueblos enteros. Ahorita, la disputa es sobre our way of life.
The dispute is over our way of life.
Sam, thank you so much for sharing the story with us.
Thank you so much. And I really appreciate you, you know, paying attention to a war that's happening very far away from the wars that are often in the news right now. So thank you.
Samantha Schmidt covers Latin America for The Post. Before we wrap today's show, we've got a couple more headlines for you. Today, the president of Columbia University faced tough questions from lawmakers on Capitol Hill about what the university has done to fight campus anti-Semitism. This is somewhat of a sequel to a hearing that took place last December. You might remember when the heads of Harvard, MIT, and the University of Pennsylvania were grilled by Republican lawmakers. They were accused of permitting anti-Semitic threats and calls for genocide. In the aftermath, the presidents of both Harvard and Penn ended up resigning. In today's hearing, Columbia President Manoush Shafiq pushed back on accusations that the university is tolerant of anti-Semitism. Here's one exchange in which she responds to Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik's questions about a professor's pro-Hamas comments.
I share with you your repugnance at those remarks. I completely understand that. On my watch, faculty who make remarks that cross the line in terms of anti-Semitism, there will be consequences for them.
What are the consequences in this case?
I have five cases at the moment who have either been either taken out of the classroom or dismissed.
And in other news, we have some new reporting about last month's bridge collapse in Baltimore. An investigation by The Post found that the kind of mechanical failure that led to a cargo ship crashing into the bridge was not at all a one-off. In fact, according to records reviewed by our colleagues, there have been hundreds of incidents in which massive cargo ships have lost propulsion. Many were near bridges and ports. Around Baltimore alone, it's happened nearly two dozen times in the past 3 years. What does that tell us? Experts are saying that American ports have struggled to adapt to the new realities of more massive container ships. They're calling for more consistent rules on when cargo ships should be escorted by tugboats that can keep them on course even if engines turn off. That's it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. Today's show was produced by Alana Gordon. It was mixed by Sean Carter and edited by Monica Campbell. Thank you also to Maggie Penman, Arturo Torres, and Peter Finn. I'm Martine Powers. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from The Washington Post.